This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we will visit with Stanley Roberts, former LSU basketball great. He was a number one draft choice in 1990, spent 8 years in the NBA, came back, and at the age of 42, last December, 2 months ago, he received his college degree from Louisiana State University, Stanley Roberts. Also on the show, Jackie Collins, the fabulous novelist, sister of Joan, who is here to talk about her latest work, The Power Trip, and two powerful people in the Louisiana GOP hierarchy, John Treen and Mike Chittum, will talk about differing visions for the Republican Party as President Obama gears up for tomorrow night's State of the Union address, and it'll be Marco Rubio, not Bobby Jindal, delivering the rebuttal. We'll talk about it with Treen and Chittum. Now the news. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Coming later in the hour, we will hear from Republicans Michael Chittum and John Treen, and also the fabulous novelist Jackie Collins. We begin with Stanley Roberts. He was a first-round draft pick out of LSU in 1990 and spent 8 years in the NBA and came back home. And last December, 2 months ago, he received his college degree from the Old War School at the age of 42 years old. He just turned 43. Happy birthday, Stanley, by the way. Stanley Roberts joining us from New York City today. Are you there, Stanley?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay.
Can you hear me, Jim?
You can hear you just fine. Well, you came to LSU as a highly touted player, perhaps the most recruited player in the country after leading a school in South Carolina, Lower Richland, to two championships. How did you end up at LSU in the first place? All right.
LSU and Craig Carson, Johnny Jones, who called me every evening and talked how great it is at LSU and how great the city of Baton Rouge was. And, you know, and until Dale Brown walked through my doors, I didn't grasp the concept of how great the program was at LSU. And I remember sitting down with Dale for the first time in my living room, and Coach Brown was, you know, giving me the spiel of how great the city was and how great Baton Rouge was. And he said something that just registered with me, and I never forgot it. And he basically told me that he was recruiting me as a person, not as a player. And that just stuck with me, and that just, you know, made me feel like, okay, I'm going to a place that it's like home.
Right.
You know, it's like a family. I got that family sense from LSU, and, you know, I made the decision to come there.
And you left early to pursue a career in the NBA, as many others have done, and you were well short of your degree. And then at one point in your life, I guess in your late 30s, you decided, you know, I'd like to get a college degree. And it wasn't a simple act, was it? You had to start all over.
Yes. Dale Brown had been, since the day I left school, has always been on me to come back and finish my degree. And he always stressed how important it was to get my degree. And I just remember sitting in Houston in my home and kind of bored. And I was like, well, let me see what it's all about. And I made that call. And unfortunately, when I left school prior, half the course, the majority of the courses wasn't even offered anymore. So basically I had to file academic bankruptcy and start all over. And it was interesting.
But you stayed the course, and in December you received your degree from LSU. In what field?
Sports administration and leadership.
All right. Stanley Roberts, a college graduate at 42 years old. And in addition to playing in the NBA 8 years, you had the wear and tear to show for it. A lot of injuries along the way, right?
Yes. I think I've had at least, for basketball alone, I've had about 12 to 13 surgeries.
13 surgeries for basketball, and at the beginning of your final semester, you underwent heart bypass surgery, didn't you?
Yes. That'd be the 14th one, I guess.
Yeah, that's the biggest, and I'm told it was a close call.
Yes. It was actually, I got to say that I was blessed that my general doctor, Dr. Hahnemann, requested that I just go in for a checkup. And I just went in for a checkup, and they found that I needed to have emergency surgery.
What was it, a triple, quadruple bypass?
It was a triple.
Triple bypass for a man who's only 42 years old, but 7 feet tall. And what are you towing the scales at today?
About 352.
352. And what were you prior to the surgery, Stanley?
I was about 497.
497
No,
pounds.
397. I'm sorry, 397. I was almost 400 pounds. Yeah, 397.
That's still a huge man. And
yes, it is. Especially when I'm used to playing at 325 to 330.
Well, it is remarkable how big a man Stanley Roberts is. And Shaquille O'Neal was at LSU the same time Stanley was. And he said the toughest guy who ever guarded him was Stanley Roberts.
Well, yeah. I mean, we got to practice a lot against each other. So we got to know each other pretty well. So it made my job a lot easier in the NBA to guard him. I can tell you that.
But the 1 year you played together, a lot of people thought you'd win the national championship. You didn't do it. Do you feel like there's some work that was left undone?
Yes. That was one of the greatest teams, I think, ever. And we came up short. It was due to, I think, the lack of not having a strong enough bench, I am, in my opinion. Everything else was great. I mean, we had a great starting five, and we had two great reserves, but we couldn't go deep. And when we ran into Georgia Tech, they went deep on us, and they was a sharp-shooting team. I mean, three-point experts, and Dennis Scott and Brian Oliver and Kenny Anderson. And they just made some incredible three-pointers down the stretch.
297-5633 or Inkster Show at WRKF.org. If you'd like to talk to Stanley, here's Hugh at LSU. Hugh, you're on the air with Stanley Roberts. Hi, Hugh.
How you doing? Hey, hi, Stanley.
Hey, Hugh, how you
doing? First of all, congratulations on your graduation. Was that Laura Lindsay in that picture giving you your degree?
Yes.
Boy, let me tell you, I know Laura, and that was just one good picture that was on the web, you know, for LSU.
All right. Do you have a question, Hugh?
Let me ask you a question, Stanley. If the LSU Sports Hall of Fame admitted Pete Maravich, because he didn't graduate, but he was such a great shining person at LSU, played basketball, they got the arena named after him and everything. Would you resent that? Would you mind that since you did graduate?
You're not in yet. All right. Well, what about that? Pete Maravich, who has the arena named in his honor, the leading scorer in the history of college basketball, is not a member of the LSU Athletic Hall of Fame, even though the Hall of Fame is housed in the Pete Maravich Assembly Center. Stanley, is there some irony to this?
Yes, it is. I have no problem in inducting him. I think he should be. He's one of the greatest players in LSU history, and I think he should be honored.
Okay.
In that fashion.
David asks about that game in 1990, and I'm looking it up. It was February 3rd, 1990, Loyola Marymount, LSU, maybe the greatest game any of us have ever seen who've been in the Assembly Center. LSU won that game, 148-141 in overtime, and I'm looking at Stanley Roberts' stats. Stanley, you were 10 of 10 from the field, 12 rebounds, 21 points. Not a bad game.
Well, not a bad game. And you know, that 10 of 10 is kind of misleading because, you know, Laola was averaging a shot every 3 seconds. So a lot of those plays I never really got back. It was just a long court pass. I was on the other end. So it was a lot of dunks and layups. But
well, 10 of 10.
You know,
Looking, Shaquille was 9 of 12. He had 24 rebounds and 32 points. Chris Jackson had 42 points in that game. And on the Loyola side, my goodness, it was 34 points, by the way, for Chris Jackson, 34 for him. And Hank Gathers had 48 points, and he died a few weeks later. I recall interviewing him after the game. He looked like a picture of health, but he had a heart condition, and he went down and died on the court a few weeks after that. But that game is seared in the memory banks of just about anybody who was within earshot of the Assembly Center on that day. It's hard to believe it's been 23 years, but it has. Stanley, you had some great times at LSU, but when you left, you still had, what, 3 years of eligibility remaining?
Yes.
So or do you regret not staying longer?
Yes, I do. I do. I think I needed the time to mature a little bit. But, you know, it was at that time, it was a decision that I had to make. You know, I had felt academically, I didn't make the 2.0. I had like a 1.75, and I was going to have to sit out the first part of the basketball season that following year, and I just didn't want to do that. And so I made the decision to leave. But I wish I would have stayed, but you know, it's in the past, and there's really nothing I can do about it. All I can do is try to right the wrongs of my life, and I think going back to school and getting my degree is one of the wrongs that I should have done the first time.
Well, you have the degree now, and you're working for the CBI Shaw Group, and I understand you're doing some work right now in New York City. And in fact, Stanley is joining us from Queens this morning. But how will the degree help you at this point in your life?
Well, you know, it's kind of weird. You know, I told my friends that are thinking of going back to school to get their degree. I tell them, you know, a lot of these companies, I believe, really don't care what your degree is. You know, they look at it as something that you committed yourself to, something that you worked towards. You've shown determination. You've shown the work ethic. And I think that's what the companies are looking at. For me, you know, like I said, I got my degree in sports administration, but I work for one of the leading technology companies and construction companies in the world, in CBI / Shaw. And it was because of the degree. You know, and if I didn't have that degree, I don't think I'd be working for him.
Well, at 7 feet tall, 352 pounds, and past 40 years old, I'm sure you were somewhat of an eye catcher on campus.
Yes. It was weird. I mean, going back to school, looking at the young kids and just realizing that I had kids almost their age, it really kind of made me feel old. But it also, you know, a lot of the kids asked me a lot of questions about life outside of college and what to look for when they got out in the real world. And I just felt like it was an honor and it was a blessing for me to be able to help those kids in that way.
Your kids are athletes in their own right, aren't they?
Yes. I got a couple of that's pretty good athletes. I install education first with my kids. Well, actually, God first, then education. But it's two of them that just are determined to play sports, and the other two decided that they wanted to go the academic route, which I'm very happy of.
How tall are they?
Proud of.
How tall are they, Stanley?
They all. My oldest, she is Stanisha. She is 6'2". She's 21. She's in college, as doing a dual major. My son, who's 16, he is 6'8". He plays high school basketball.
All right, hold that thought. We'll be back to wrap it up with Stanley Roberts and hear from Mike Chittum and John Treen. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, it's 877-217-5757. In just a moment, we'll hear from John Treen and Mike Chittum, but we're wrapping it up with Stanley Roberts, the former LSU basketball stalwart, who graduated in December at the age of 42, all 7 feet tall, 352 pounds of him. Stanley Roberts, as we went to the break, you were talking about your children. You got the two of them, and they're two others, and I understand they're like their dad, of course. They're big people. They're tall people.
Yeah. But, you know, they're all over 6 feet. You know, I think my son, oldest boy, is the tallest at 6'8". He's still growing at the age of 16, so... And I'm hoping that he makes it to at least 6'10", 6'11", if not 7 feet.
Yeah, you wouldn't want him to be a midget.
No, I wouldn't. I wouldn't want him. He don't want to be a midget neither, so.
And anybody under about 6'5 is a midget to Stanley.
Yes, yes. And luckily my girls didn't grow over 6'2", so I'm kind of happy about that.
All right. Well, good luck to you, my friend, and congratulations. College graduate in sports administration from LSU at the age of 42, now 43 years young, Stanley Roberts. Thank you, Stanley.
Thank you, Jim.
Take care. See you soon. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
We're joined now by Republicans Mike Chittum and John Treen. I think John got choked up with Stanley's interview. But they, of course... been involved for many years in the GOP goings-on in this community. And I, just out of curiosity, are either of you guys members of the Tea Party?
I am.
You are, John?
Yes.
Really?
Yes. I've attended a lot of the meetings, and I'm in sympathy with some of what they do. I don't think they're always right. But then I don't think that most organizations aren't always right.
Mike Chittum?
I definitely am a member of the Tea Party.
Do you like what the Tea Party stands for?
I like most of what they stand for. I, you know, can disagree with people, but I still like most of what they stand for. I do support most of the actions.
Okay. 297-5633 or 877-217-5757. Those are your numbers for Mike Chittum and John Treen. Bobby Jindal, the governor of Louisiana, who, of course, is a Republican of renown, quite possibly will be the Republican nominee for president in 2016. Here's what he said a few weeks ago about his fellow GOP cohorts.
Fourth thing we've got to do, we've got to stop being the stupid party. And I'm serious, it's time for a new Republican Party that talks like adults. It's time for us to articulate our plans and our visions for America in real terms. It's no secret we had a number of Republicans that damaged the brand this year with offensive and bizarre comments. I'm here to say we've had enough of that.
What do you think, Mike Chittum?
Well, the governor is right on a couple of things. I don't know if he's right on all of us being stupid, but I would think that we have the ability to put forward decent candidates. I mean, our team this coming up is going to be fantastic with Rubio and Mike and Mr. Ryan and people like that. So I'm really excited about it.
All right. John Treen, were you offended by the governor's remarks?
Yes, I think he is in error there. It's not a stupid party. We have made some mistakes, but everybody makes mistakes. There's only been one perfect person in the history of the world, and he's been gone nearly 2,000 years. So to criticize a party because it makes a mistake, I think, is outrageous. I think that the biggest mistake the party has made is not explaining in terms the average person can understand how they were going to increase the number of jobs in this country, which is not a hard thing to do if you follow sensible rules. But... we were at fault for not giving adequate information and explaining in terms that the average man can understand our programs and how they will benefit America and benefit them as individuals.
So can Bobby Jindal be the Republican nominee in 2016?
No.
Why not?
Well, several reasons. One is he's lost a lot of popularity in his own home state. Secondly... I think that he has a tendency to talk very rapidly, and while I agree with a lot of his positions, I think that he has not adequately explained himself, and I think that he is He's just not. He doesn't have the kind of experience, I think, that would make a good president. So I don't think he has a chance of getting the nomination. For one thing, being from Louisiana or Mississippi, Alabama is not a plus in running for the presidency, as you know. And
what about Arkansas?
Well, it worked one time.
Also, Georgia, John.
Well, Georgia's a little different. I think Georgia's would be better than Louisiana. These states are states with few electoral votes and that are overwhelmingly Republican now anyway in presidential, so they don't need them to carry a state or carry an area. So my guess is that in the future we will probably pick candidates and should pick candidates from the swing areas because that would be more helpful in winning the election. I think having someone like Ron Portman of Ohio would be a good man.
All right. Well, before we get to the field for 2016, Mike Chittum, my impression is that you believe the governor of Louisiana could get the GOP nomination.
I've seen things happen all the time. I think Governor General could possibly get the nomination. The thing that amazes me is that we've been picking candidates because they, how shall I say it, they tend to appeal to the money people and not to the people that vote. I would like to see some of us get in there and do what we did with Mr. Reagan, in which we had a coalition of people, you know, fiscal hawks, defense hawks, people that would look at the things and mm-hmm. explain, as John said rightly, to the people of the United States what's going on. I think that's what we need to look forward to, not just because somebody can get elected. I think we have to also put forward the people that have ideas out there.
All right. In Saturday's edition of the New York Times, in a column by Charles Blow, who's, by the way, a graduate of Grambling, he writes, Louisiana's Governor Bobby Jindal, speaking at the Republican National Committee meeting last month, chastised his party for being the stupid party, that it's in love with zeros, even as he insisted, I'm not one of those who believe we should moderate, equivocate, or otherwise abandon our principles. Jindal's plan, writes Mr. Blow, like many other Republicans, boils down to two words, talk differently. Other Republicans, like Marco Rubio, seem to want to go further. They understand that the party must behave differently. He's among a group of senators who recently put forward a comprehensive immigration proposal that would offer a pathway to citizenship for the millions of undocumented immigrants in this country. John Treen, what's your stand on immigration?
I am very much opposed to this amnesty program that they're putting forth now. And let me tell you why. We have over 10 million unemployed Americans in this country. One reason so many Americans are unemployed is because so many people come from Mexico and Central America and other countries and take the jobs that would go to Americans. I think that we should not be bringing people, let people come into this country to take jobs away from Americans when Americans are out of work. And this not only causes them to be out of work, but it costs us a lot of money in welfare payments, food stamp programs, and so forth. And if these 10 million Mexicans or Central Americans would go back home, there would be a lot of jobs. They would leave a lot of jobs open for Americans.
John has one opinion. Mike, do you differ or do you agree with John?
Well, I want border security as much as the next person. I think that's what we have to do to start with. We have to have border security. But you got 11 million people here in the United States, and, you know, I don't think they're going to go home. Right now, I don't see any administration trying to get them to go home. I think we've got to work with some kind of plan out there. I'm not in favor of amnesty, but there's got to be some way to bring some of these people out of the woodwork and things like that. Yeah, I'd love to see them. If you could make all the lawbreakers go away, fine. I just don't think you can do that. And I'm looking forward to a plan maybe that will bring something about. But first, I will say you have to secure the borders. After you secure the borders, then maybe we can discuss the rest of it.
You think that's one of the big issues in the world today in the United States is to secure the borders?
No, I think the big issue in the United States today is jobs, jobs and jobs.
But
and
that's you want to secure the borders
I do
to
want
do
to secure the borders.
297-5633 for Republicans Mike Chittum and John Treen. John?
Let me make this point. If in this country any person or company that hired an illegal alien was fined, say, $3,000 a month, and the person who reported that to the immigration department would get half of that as a reward, you'd pretty soon have these people leaving this country. And I think that this is what we should do. One of the things I think is disturbing is that our minority population in this country, largely black people, are being hurt by immigration more than anyone else, and we should be helping them, not hurting them. And if it became a situation where they couldn't get a job, they'd have to leave. And I think that's what we should do. Also, I think it is wrong to let people come across this country illegally, because they should always be checked for medical reasons, physical reasons, and disease, and checked for a criminal record.
All right. Well, the president, in his State of the Union address tomorrow night, is expected to use the address to press lawmakers to back an immigration overhaul, including a pathway for citizenship for 11 million illegal immigrants, and also to tout gun control proposals. What do you make of this activity involving the White House and some members of Congress, John Treen and Mike Chittum? Mike?
Well, gun control isn't going to go anywhere, and they might as well just give it up now. I don't think they'll have the clout to put that forward. I think even some of the Democratic senators, including Mr. Reid, is running as far as he can. He won't bring it up. As far as immigration control is, reform is, I think we do have to have some reforms. Again, I stress that we have to secure the borders, and I don't want to play one group against the other.
All right, John?
I think that we need to secure the borders, first of all. That's very important. But I think to allow people to be rewarded for breaking the law is going to encourage it to happen over and over again. You can secure the borders, but they'll come by ship. They'll come all kinds of ways to get into this country. Now, I think the way to solve the immigration problem is to put a fine, heavy fine on anyone who hires an illegal alien. And then have, because you can call in and verify, there's an e-verify system right now. You can find out whether a person's here legally or not. And then if you do that, have them go back home, because one of the things we have to recognize is Mexico's population is growing very, very rapidly and has for the last 100 years. And if it keeps growing, they're going to keep trying to find ways to get people into this country.
All right. Well, the Republicans did very poorly with Hispanics in the 2012 election, at least Governor Romney did in his quest to unseat President Obama. And that brings us to Senator Marco Rubio, Hispanic senator from Florida, who will be the person who will offer the response to President Obama tomorrow night, like Bobby Jindal did 4 years ago. And for those who have gotten a glimpse at what Senator Rubio is expected to discuss tomorrow evening, he is expected to question climate change. Mike Chittum, is this a surprise?
No, it's not a surprise, but I would hope that he would do other things besides just question climate change. I think that we should, again, focus on the job situation and also the other issues out there. But climate change is not, I don't think, a big, big thing in the Republican Party right now, nor in the nation.
All right, John, what do you think about Rubio?
I think that's correct. And besides, we've had climate change. Let me give you an example. About 800 years ago, there was an island in the Pacific called Greenland. Why was it called Greenland? Because there were a lot of trees and a lot of green there. There's none there now. Climate change has been going on in the world since the beginning of the world. So, yes, we have climate change, and I do think that the issue confronting the country today is not climate change so much, although that is an issue. It's not a major issue. The major issue is the economy, and I think the another major issue is going to be the rise of the fundamentalist Islamists and their threat to the world and to the United States.
Dan downtown. Dan, you're on the air. Good morning to you.
Yes, Mr. Treen, you recommend sanctions against employers who hire illegal aliens. Do you have any suggestions how we could deal with all the corporate lobbyists that are hired, including ex-congressmen, in order to protect employers so they get away with this stuff?
Well, I know that is a problem, but I'm just saying that we're looking for solutions, and I think that this is a solution. I didn't say it's going to be easy to do and that it wouldn't be opposed. But as a practical matter, a lot of employers like having these foreigners in here because they work for less money. And some of them, by the way, have a very good work ethic, and I know that's true. Some of the Mexican construction workers, I was in the construction business for over 50 years, some of the Mexican construction workers are very skilled and very good. Mm-hmm. But the point is that we owe to our own people in this country first consideration when it comes to economic progress.
Now, both of you gentlemen were on this show prior to the election and predicted a victory for Governor Romney. What happened?
I think what happened is that Romney, in the last week or so of the campaign, did very, very little, and he did not get into the process of explaining to the American public how he was going to improve the American economy. Let me give you an example. One reason we've lost jobs overseas is because the cost of production in this country is too high. I don't know whether you know this, but 22% of the wholesale price of manufactured products in this country is federal tax.
All right, but prior to the election, John, when it was actually CNN had it 47-47 a couple of days before the election, that would have left 6% undecided. You said those votes would go to Romney. It looks like they went to the president. Well, how did that happen?
Well, I don't think there's one explanation, but I think that one thing that happened is that Romney in the last few days of the campaign was practically unseen. And the other thing I think that happened is that the Democrats obviously had a much better grassroots ground game than we did.
John, what do you think, Mike, about John's remarks?
Well, John's right on one thing. They did Romney was unseen, and the Democrats had a
unseen,
great—
Unseen? He was all over the place campaigning.
Well, let me put it this way. He wasn't explaining himself as well as he could, but I don't agree that it was just that. I think it was the ground game the Democrats put forward. I mean, they had people going door to door where we just sat on our tails and thought, hey, we got this thing won. That was the problem we had. We did not have any excitement out there. We just didn't seem to move forward. I think also the last debate kind of hurt us. I think that Romney was trying to play defense instead of offense.
Well, Democrats have won the popular vote in five of the last six presidential elections. Is there a sea change in America now in which Democrats are in control when it comes to national elections?
I don't think there's a sea change out there. I think that you have about
40%. Because we have more and more people moving into as a dependence on the federal government. And I think the more this happens, the more the Democrats will prosper. And we have to find a way to explain why this is not
when
good.
Well, when you say this, though, anybody who works at a public university is dependent upon the government for their paycheck. Bobby Jindal's dependent upon the governor for his, or government for his paycheck. He always has been.
I'm not talking about that kind of employee.
He would be a Democrat if he's in favor of government-supported paychecks.
I didn't say that. You're missing the point. I'm talking about the dependency people on welfare programs. I'm talking about welfare. I'm not talking about people who legitimately work for the government and hold a decent job for the government. I'm talking about people who are being given money by the federal government. I think that this culture of dependency is spreading in this country.
You don't think there's some deadhead jobs out there in government, John?
There certainly are. In fact, Louisiana has the highest per capita number of state employees in the South. Did you know that? And so we have some.
I think most people who work for state government in Louisiana are dedicated public servants, but I can tell you, last week, for example, at Bayou Bash, there were actually state workers on state time at Bayou Bash. How do you explain that? We'll talk more with John Treen and Mike Chittum after this 90-second pause on WRKF. This is Jim Engster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Kevin Gallagher is producing. 297-5633, Republicans Mike Chittum and John Treen surveying the landscape, and they are prominent politicos in Louisiana. The Republican Party is in charge in our state when it comes to statewide elective office, Mary Landrieu being the only Democrat elected statewide, and she's up for re-election next year. Is she beatable, John Treen?
I think that she is, although she does have some strength here with a lot of people. But I will remind you, in the last three elections, she won each one by very narrow margins. And in each case, the state party insisted on running candidates against her who were weak candidates.
All right. John has made his case that Landrieu is beatable. John, what do you think, Mike?
I think she's definitely beatable. And I think the state party has chosen some definitely good candidates and some definitely bad candidates. But I'm in favor of a state convention to choose our candidate. And I know that's far-fetched and things like that, but maybe a good state convention where we bring all the Republicans together and choose a candidate. But we've got the congressman here, the Cassidy. Then you've got the head of the education board here, Mr. Romer. I mean, we've got great candidates out there, and I'm looking forward to this race. This is a definitely winnable race, but I think that the state party should convene a convention which we choose our nominee.
In a poll conducted by the Louisiana State Medical Society, Mary Landrieu, according to this survey, is the most popular public official in the state, and the governor had his worst poll numbers ever, showing that 46% like what he's doing and 48% do not like what the governor is doing. Let's go to Randy and Zachary. Randy, please be brief. You're on with John.
Getting back to the subject of immigration, I believe that every country has a legitimate right to control its borders. Thanks.
All right. Betty in City Park. Hi, Betty.
Oh, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I'd just like to say, you know, I kind of agree with some of the things that the panel is saying, but I'd like to offer this to the Republican Party. When you ask the question, how did Governor Romney fail? Why are some of the Republicans failing? Is because they're teaching divisiveness. And what they're also doing is now they're trying to Band-Aid something that they've opened a great wound up to, and that's to, you know, try to lean towards the immigrants that are here now. People want, no matter who's in office, to speak the truth.
All right, Mike. Thank you, Betty.
I think that we need to speak the truth, as you said, and I do think we have to have some reform. Again, I say that we have to secure the borders first before we can do anything else, and I think that's something we have to do. But as far as Republicans opening Band-Aids and wounds, this administration that we have now in Washington, D.C. is one of the most partisan administrations we've ever had. Look at the things they've been doing. Look at Obamacare, which is going to cost us billions of dollars and ruin the health care system in the United States.
John, what do you think?
I think that he's right about Obamacare. I know that, let me put it this way. I think Obama is well-intentioned, but I think his lack of experience in the business world is very damaging. I would point something out.
Well, you think health care was going great guns and was affordable and available to the American people at a competitive price before the president got his plan in place?
I'm not saying that everybody could afford all the medical care they wanted. What I'm saying is we had a very good medical system here in this country. And what he has done to this medical system now is going to load it down with costs because of all the rules and regulations. A lot of doctors are going to I know several doctors who are going to retire, and they tell me a lot of them are when this comes into effect because they don't want to have to put up with it. And now the med schools are having less and less people applying to med school because, and this they blame that on Obamacare.
Phil in Jefferson Terrace. Hi, Phil. You're on with Mike and Dave.
Good morning,
Mike
gentlemen.
And John.
Mike and John. Okay. Good morning, sir. And thank you, gentlemen. But I just have to say, as a voter myself, who's been voting for a long time, and also witness to the results of the policies and the ideology of the Republican Party. I mean, we just frankly outright reject your policies and the ideology. We kind of know what happens when you go to war without funding it. And we see what happens when the taxes are reduced. All you guys talk about is cutting taxes. It's not about what you say. It's what your party does.
Mike?
Well, first of all, since you said that you've rejected it, that's okay. I think Louisiana certainly hasn't rejected it, and I think you're darn wrong about that. I think you just look at some of the facts. Again, I think that we need somebody up there in Washington, D.C. that will look out for the people, as they say. But, yes, we need to cut the taxes. It's going to be murder out there in the next couple of years. Wait till Obamacare kicks in and we're just flooded with new taxes all over the place, medical devices, people being laid off
of work.
Well,
should the governor refuse the Medicaid money?
Yes, he should.
Why should he refuse?
Because
it?
I think that we need somebody to take a stand. And finally, we have somebody who will take a stand. I salute the governor if he'd do that.
What do you think, John?
Well, that's something I don't feel qualified to answer, but I will say this, that the Obamacare program, one of the things about higher taxes is that when you tax people's money and take it away from them, that's money they don't have to spend on goods and services that create jobs. And when you try to put a lot of tax on wealthy, and I'm not wealthy, but I want you to know that people who have a lot of money, they spend them a lot of money. They put money into savings and loans. They contribute to charities, and they invest money to create jobs. Now, if you take that money away from them, let the government spend it, then that's money. You have less money for charities, less money for savings, which finances businesses and purchases of homes and cars, and you're going to have less money invested to create jobs.
Do you think, John, that you can address this overwhelming deficit that we have without raising some taxes?
Yes, I think the way to do it is to increase jobs, and the way to do that is to reduce the cost of production in this country. And the United States government can do so by reducing it probably by 25 or 30% if they just change some of their ways of doing things. Because right now they're causing, by the way, we have the highest corporate income tax in the world. Now, people say, well, that's the corporations paying the tax. Well, where does the corporations get the money? They get it out of the pockets of the people who buy their services and their goods. So when you tax a corporation, you're taxing the people. But what happens is when we have the highest tax rate in the world, that means that our costs are higher, and that means that jobs go overseas. It doesn't make good sense. We should have a different tax. What we should do is to try to solve our budget problems by expanding the tax base more.
All right. We've got a caller who's been waiting in line, and I'm sorry, I do not have your name. What is it?
LaConte.
Okay, LaConte. Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Baton Rouge, Louisiana.
All right, LaConte. What's on your mind?
What's on my mind is earlier one of your guests made a statement that Greenland was green and then it turned into an icy place. That particular place actually was sold under the pretense that it was Greenland, but it wasn't. Part of the problem with the Republican Party is that the rhetoric and the things that are said are just not true.
All right. Well, we're short on time, and we thank you for your comments and for setting the record straight on Greenland. John Treen, always nice to talk with you, sir.
Thank you, sir.
And John is the older brother of the late, great David Treen. And nice to visit with you as well, Mike Chittum.
Thank you.
And now we switch gears. And we're pleased to visit with the fascinating Jackie Collins. She's talking about her latest work, The Power Trip. She has written 28 novels, all of which have appeared on the New York Times bestseller list. Good morning, Jackie Collins.
Good morning, Jim. How are you?
Doing well.
Good. Thank you.
Now, your books have sold over 500 million copies. They've been translated into 40 languages. 8 of your novels have been adapted for the screen, either as films or television miniseries. How do you keep doing it?
You know, I think when you want to tell stories and you want to write books, you have to have a passion for it. And I have a passion for it. It's something I love to do. And I see all these people go, oh, I want to write, and they do one book, and then they go away, and you never see them again. And it's something that, you know, I think I was born with the gift of telling stories.
Well, you can tell them like few other people. How did you develop this fascination?
When I was a kid, I was very much a loner. So I would be at school, and all the other kids would go off to parties and things, and I would say, no, I have to go home, I have to read. And I would read everything in sight. And by the time I was 13, I was well into Harold Robbins and books like that. And I thought, I can do this. You know, this is something I want to do. I want to tell these stories. And so I started to write, and I wrote a lot of unfinished books. And then when I was in my early 20s, I finally finished my first book, The World is Full of Married Men, and it was about very strong women and men who cheated on their wives and didn't get away with it. And it was an instant success, and I've never looked back.
That was 1968. That was a few years ago.
I know. I've been doing it a long time, Jim.
And you keep doing it.
I'm still enjoying every second of it.
Well, tell us about The Power Trip.
The Power Trip is very timely because it's, my publishers calls it a sun-drenched thriller. And it is sun-drenched, so when you read the book, you feel like you're in a very hot climate. And it's about this group of people. This Russian billionaire takes his supermodel girlfriend on a new yacht to celebrate her birthday in Cabo St. Lucas. And they take with them 5 very famous couples. They take with them a politician and his wife, a 50-something movie star and his 20-something girlfriend, a gay Latin singing superstar and his older boyfriend, and a black footballer and his beautiful designer wife. And these people all go off to have this luxury cruise, and they're having this fantastic time with champagne and caviar and white sand and beaches. And all of a sudden, Mexican gangsters become involved, and they are pirated by Somali pirates.
It's a great story. You have a fertile imagination, and it hasn't stopped. I think it's even gotten more vivid through the years, Jackie.
Well, I think, you know, that the and I researched this very carefully, the Somali pirates are not staying where they usually stay. They are getting closer. And I was on a yacht in, I was going from the south of France to Sardinia on a friend's yacht. And in the middle of the night, I just felt uneasy, and I got up and I went upstairs and I talked to the captain. And I said, "Where are we?" And he said, "Well, we're halfway there." He said, "It takes 5 hours." He said, "But we're over clear water the whole time. There's no land." And I thought to myself, wow, you know, this billionaire owned the yacht. And I thought, what if we were pirated? And the idea for the book came from that. And then, of course, I put in all my characters that I love writing about, the cheating politician. I mean, if you read the papers and you read about what politicians have gotten up to in the last couple of years, it's unbelievable. So I thought I wanted to do a more believable one. But he does, you know, chase all the interns and is not a very nice person. So it was interesting developing the bad characters and the good characters, because I have Flynn, who's this very handsome guy who's kind of like a Navy SEAL who really saves them all in the end. But you'll have to read it to find out how he saves them.
When you say he's a very handsome guy, what is a handsome guy to you?
A handsome guy to me is a guy with integrity. I think integrity and a sense of humor makes a guy much better than the sum of all his good looks.
You have written about Hollywood like few other people, maybe no other person, and this is from a lady who, of course, was born in London. Hollywood's been a big part of your life in the last several years, hasn't it?
It really has. You know, I was thrown out of school when I was 15, and my sister, older sister, was making movies in Hollywood with Paul Newman and Joanne Woodward, and my parents said to me, "You're uncontrollable." You know, I think they just wanted to get rid of me, so they put me on a plane and sent me to Hollywood to stay with her. And it was the most amazing experience of my life. And I wrote about it in Hollywood Wives, actually. All the people and characters in Hollywood Wives are people I met then. And I think that because I'm English, I've got an English sense of humor, so I can be more of an observer and observe the scene of what's going on in Hollywood and kind of, you know, I call myself an anthropologist crawling through the jungles of Hollywood, watching what goes on. So when I write my books, they are based very much on the truth. I am not outside the mansion with my nose pressed against the glass trying to get in. I'm in the mansion watching the characters.
You have to have incredible discipline to do what you do. How do you do it? Do you write every day?
I do write every day. In fact, I'm writing a book now called Confessions of a Wild Child, and it's Lucky Santangelo, one of my most popular characters, when she was 15. So I've gone back in time. But, yeah, I write in longhand still. I do all my research on the computer, but I love to write in longhand because I love to. I have nice writing, and I like to see the pages, and then I like to have it bound in leather when I finish the book. So what you see is what you get, because I kind of strictly edit myself as I'm writing.
In longhand, that's amazing.
Well, The Power Trip is about 2,000 longhand pages. in book size, that I think it's about 500 and something pages.
How long does it take?
It takes about 9 months to write a book. Yeah, and I love it. I love the process of creating the characters, of, you know, bringing them to life, and they become so real for me. I mean, Lucky Santangelo, I've written about in 7 books now, and I'm on Twitter, Jackie J. Collins on Twitter, and the great thing now with social media is that I'm able to communicate with my fans, and that is, to me, fantastic.
So you have adapted to the times, as we knew you would. How do you like the new environment with so much social
media? I love it.
Media?
I'm on Pinterest. I'm on Twitter. I have a Facebook page. So people can reach me now, and I can reach back to them. And I send out autographed pictures for free. I know a lot of people charge for them. And it's so nice to hear what people have to say.
Well, for someone who has written about love, as you have, this being Valentine's week, I would think The Power Trip would be an appropriate way to celebrate.
Well, so many guys have sent me tweets, and they've gone, "I'm getting this for my girlfriend on Valentine's Day. It's perfect."
The Power Trip is the latest work from the amazing Jackie Collins, and I suspect in almost every interview you're asked about your older sister, Joan. She's quite a lady, and you two have been close.
Well, she's fantastic, and in fact, she's flying into New York today. And we're having dinner tomorrow night, so I will give her your love, Jim.
Please do. And you're going to be on the Today Show, I understand.
tomorrow morning I'm on the Today Show, and on Valentine's Day I'm on Anderson Cooper, so that should be really fun.
Well, we're glad you premiered The Power Trip with us, and congratulations on another work, which I'm sure will be an overwhelming bestseller. And
thank you.
Remarkable.
Have fun taking the trip.
We will do it. Thank you, Jackie.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye. And tomorrow on this show, Ivar van Heerden will be with us. A jury trial to consider allegations concerning LSU's termination of its top coastal researcher for speaking out against the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers begins February 19th. And Ivar van Heerden, the man who is in the middle of this, will be with us tomorrow. Until then, for Kevin Gallagher, I'm Jim Inkster. Happy Lundi Gras. We'll be back live show tomorrow with Ivar van Heerden on Mardi Gras Day. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Inkster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Inkster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.